the biggest pain points for the finance industry these days is the cost of compliance. For smaller firms or mid-sized firms, it's costing so much money. You had the COVID, then Russia starts to play difficult, energy crisis, inflation. So we're trying to make that cost of compliance significantly lower than it used to be.
Welcome to Mangtas Nation Season 2. This season is all about tech of the future. We'll be sharing real-world experiences and featuring astounding guests to help guide you in your tech journey. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
I'm ready.
The show starts right now.
Hello, everyone. This is Jackie DeMenk, together with Wouter Delbare, and welcome to the Mangtas Nation podcast. In today's episode, we roll out our red carpet and bring out some beers for a very special Belgian guest. He saw a gap in the finance industry and set to fill it out with his company, Elysian NXT. He's revolutionizing the way financial institutions manage risk and comply with regulations, making it more efficient and cost-effective. With his leadership and expertise, he is paving the way in the fintech industry and shaping the future of finance. Listeners, it's time to get some deeper insights from the CEO and founder of Elysian NXT, Chris Pepe. Wow, Chris, thank you for being here with us today.
Thanks, Jackie. Thanks for the great introduction.
Well, we're definitely thrilled to have you here today to share your insights and expertise with our listeners. But before we dive into the conversation, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your background, Chris?
Sure. As you said, I'm originally from Belgium, but I'm currently, my home is Bangkok, Thailand. So I say an old guy in industry. Started my first company when I was 30. Started my second company was when I was 50. So these are quite pivotal years in a man's life. Background educationally, I've got a master in economics and one in IT. Started my career in finance, Ernst & Young auditor. Several years, then switched to IT side on the vendor space for working for Dun & Bradstreet Software. You have to remember these were the good old mainframe days, so nothing what you see these days. And I started working for a small Belgian company at that time, which was FICS. I was sent to London for 3 years working for an investment bank as a consultant on a project which was basically building an enterprise-wide sub-budget for financial controllers. So working in that kind of high speed, a lot of pressure environment, also first time working abroad, changed basically or shaped my further career. Took me out of my comfort zone. So after then 3 years together with Dirk, who was also working on the same project, we kind of started our first company together.
Tell us a bit more about this company, Chris, and why you actually decided
to get start, out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, even further, right? From Belgium to the UK, but then say, hey, now we take the bigger leap. Let's do a company.
Well, we saw that what we were building was kind of a great, unique set of data, which was used by financial controls to do different things for REC reporting purposes, for finance, for risk. We tried, Derek and myself, we tried to sell it in-house to the company to say that it's a great idea, that let's build a product out of it. But the company at the time was not interested to go into that direction. So we sat together and said, why are we not trying to do it ourselves? We think that idea has great potential, and let's give it a shot. You have to remember that at the time, we're talking about shortly before the year 2000, so a lot of financial institutions were replacing their core banking application. So there was an appetite for these kind of products where you have all your data sitting in one place to do a variety of things. So we were lucky that after a couple of months, one of the banks saw that that's what they need, and we had our first client. So sometimes you need a combination of maybe naivety and of being naive and having a lot of luck sometimes. And that was the start of a crazy journey, starting from an office where the two of us sat together face to face, growing the company to about 300 people with worldwide presence in the States, in Asia, name it, with some of the bigger banks as customer, Bank of New York, Commonwealth Bank of Australia. So it's such a fascinating journey. And what's great about it is that because we hired quite some young talent in Belgium and they were sent abroad very, very fast, I must say. And a lot of these, that young talent, they became entrepreneurs on their own. After like 15 years, you see a lot of spin-offs of what used to be French architects, Singapore, Australia, the Baltics, name it. It's very nice to see that young talent, found this entrepreneurial spirit, and they say, oh, okay, fine, we're going to try it ourselves as well. And that's great to see. I love that.
There are a lot of influencers today, but back in the day, Chris was the influencer, in a way.
Well, because he didn't. I would say the influencer, but it's like these young guys, they grabbed the opportunity, and it was really, you're being sent to the other side of the planet, and you have to do it. Yeah. And they thrived on that, and for some reason, there was a lot of, great talent in that company that we hired, and it's again, it's lovely to see all these entrepreneurial spin-offs from the original flagship.
And was that part of your core strategy going in? Did you know that was going to be a big part of your growth strategy to get these young kids and basically send them on a journey?
Well, we didn't do a lot of strategy, to be honest. it was a kind of, I would say, it's a big difference, as you know, working for a big company or working for a startup. Big company, you've got your strategy, all written down. Your career plan is there. With these kind of entrepreneurial, these kind of startups, they throw you in the deep end, and you have to be able to swim. And when I hired people, I always said, look, do realize that there's a massive difference between being, working for a big organization or working for, a small company. You can learn a lot, but you have to have the right mindset for it. If you have that spirit, that mindset, then you can learn so much, you can learn, in 1 year is equivalent to many years in a big organization.
And not only did you manage to start something from nothing, right? You did it with a friend, as you mentioned.
Correct.
You made it big, you went global, successful, profitable, all of that. What many entrepreneurs also strive for is an exit. So you said you have two, so you managed an exit as well, Chris. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, and I would say this is one very important lesson I always give to people who are in the startup business, to say, look, work on your cash, and lucky enough, the world is very different now than it was around the year 2000. There's a lot of cash available, there's a lot of venture capitalists. But also say, do realize, once you have a VC on board, there is an exit strategy. Now, even if it's a small percentage or more participation I can have in the company, it is an exit strategy. You know, these guys want to get out in 5 years' time. So it's kind of a, you know, I do remember that when we had our first VC on board, that Dirk came to see me and said, "Chris, this is fundamentally going to be a different game from now on, because there's now external capital on board. These guys, they have a clear exit strategy in their mind, and you do have to realize that when you start up a company, now it's a very important choice. Do I grow organically, or do I do it with the help of external capital?"
When it
and
comes,
how did that feel? Sorry, how did that feel like to exit? Like your baby all of a sudden?
It was a tough moment. Because I do realize, and I was sitting in the Bangkok office, and I said, "This is the best time of my life. It will never be so much fun anymore." You know, so selling it was kind of a painful decision. But with all respect to Dirk and the VCs on board, the VCs had a long term strategy. They support us all the way. So I fully respect their decision to say, okay, at a certain moment in time, when the price is right for all parties, and the party who's taking over the baby, that you see, okay, there's a strategy behind it, and you can live with that, then it's the right moment in time.
And then, so this is, you were 30, you started this, you exited. And then you started on a second entrepreneurial baby. You had a bug again. Yeah. You got tired of corporate. What was the thinking?
I stayed with WK, who took over Financial Architects for 5 years, with full intention, because I liked what they were doing with the company. I liked the strategy. But after a while, after 5 years, and there was a new thing coming on the market, which was called IFRS 9. It's basically calculating the expected credit losses for institutions, and that's a very fundamental change in the risk space that we are in, because for the first time banks need to take in good consideration the future, and unless you have a one of these glazed and balls that you can see the future, unless you have one of these, you have to be very flexible, very fast, because we live in a very uncertain world. So it requires lots of calculations, lots of modeling. So we realized with the technology that we had at that time, which was batch driven, I said this is impossible to do it in a timely fashion or to be able to run simulations. So we sat down with a couple of people of the old Finnair gang to say, okay, they felt the same kind of frustration from a product point of view, to say, look, we need to do something, because it's not nice having to sell a product that it's going to be difficult to meet what the banks really need with the kind of time simulations pressure that's on them. So, and that was the reason why we, at a certain point in time, we decided we're going to start a new company, which was, Elysian NXT, based around the idea, let's use, streaming technology to be able to do calculations in real time, and millions of contracts, a lot of, calculation data points, and it basically enables the banks and financial institutions to run as many simulation stress tests as they want, which is a radical difference with the traditional vendors in the space, the Moody's, the Oracles, the WKs, who still are very much batch-oriented. And you can play with modern technology like cloud technology or containerization, But you know, if you put your application, which is batch driven, in a container and you made available in the web, that doesn't solve the real underlying problem, no? Sometimes technology is misused, throwing in some buzzwords, mm-hmm. but you basically have to fundamentally redesign the entire architecture to make really optimal use of cloud technology, of orchestration, streaming technology. Otherwise, it's just a patchwork.
And I would say, of course, you're primarily focused on banks. Is that correct, Chris?
Financial institutions. Yeah,
including non-banks.
Yeah, financial firms. Yeah,
financial institutions are probably the last types of organizations to move when new technology comes. Like when it comes to cloud, many solutions were deployed a decade ahead before banks were on it, right? Now, having said that, there are also a lot of fintechs, but that's quite different because you're talking more back-end and middle-end solutions. How do you see, like, and now I guess with COVID as well, correct me if I'm wrong, the whole mindset of going on site and doing stuff also has to change. So almost cloud is almost necessary, has probably fast-tracked it. Is that correct? Has COVID actually fast-tracked the adoption of cloud-based solutions by banks and other financial institutions?
Yeah, without any doubt. Before COVID, when you went into a bank, we discussed having to do a project. I mean, all people had to work physically on site, thanks to COVID, the whole mind shift is gone because, they say we're not on site ourselves. So we don't want you guys to come here. You can work remotely. We have the cloud technology. So when we compare, COVID, post-COVID, then probably 90% of the implementation we do is pure software as a service. Yeah, and certainly in Australia and Europe, that's a common thing. I mean, Asia does have to catch up a bit. We had our first client last year with one of the digital players in Indonesia. But the majority here in Southeast Asia is still, non-cloud based.
For whatever reason. But that will change in your opinion?
Maybe I shouldn't say that, but I think one of the reasons that a lot of banks here in the region are not still cloud based is that because also IT wants to keep the buying power of all the equipment. Yeah, so it also needs a mind shift on an organizational level to say, look, you have to give up that authority, that power, because once they go into software as a service, you don't have to buy those big machines anymore. So it will come because, there's no reason not anymore because legislation is also saying, okay, the data cannot leave the country. But if you look at, for example, AWS, they are in Indonesia, they are in Singapore, they are in Thailand. So the data doesn't have to leave the data centers which are located in the country.
Okay, nice. But then now talking about this and you starting your second company, Chris, tell us a little bit more about Elysian.
So Elysian NXT is focused on bringing the world of real-time in the space of risk platforms for the financial industries. So I have to think about IFRS 9, I have to think about Basel, so credit risk, interest rate risk, liquid risk, or all the risk that banks have. And because of the real-time speed, because of the flexibility, it enables the banks not only to report on time to the regulator, but also to do lots of simulations and stress tests for their internal management purposes. So that's the focus of Elysium NXT. That's the risk platform that we have. We have now around 40 institutions across the world using our risk platform. So development center is based here in Bangkok, Thailand. We have offices in Jakarta and in Brussels. Mm-hmm. So that's the goal of the company. Is we want to, with that technology, that there's so many nice things you can do. You know, one of the things is that it reduces significantly the cost of compliance. And if you talk about the financial industry, one of the biggest pain points for the financial industry these days is the cost of compliance. Right. Certainly for smaller firms or mid-sized firms, it's costing so much money. And you know, the last 10 years they have worked in a low interest rate environment, so the profit margins were small, and you're being confronted with a lot of regulatory demands as an offset of the great financial crisis in 2008. Think about IFRS 9, think about the whole fundamental review of the trading book for your market risk, think about the changes in Basel credit risk. And this in an environment which is crazy turbulent. You know, you had the COVID, then Russia starts to play difficult, you know, energy crisis, inflation. So regulators are saying you have to do simulations. We need to see, you know, with all this happening, you know, worst case scenario, where, you know, do you have enough provisions? Do you have enough capital? So we're trying to make that cost of compliance significantly lower than it used to be. Cloud plays there in a role, because with if you have the proper technology, you have, you know, your architecture is microservice based, and you know it can work nicely in the cloud, and you can, you know, tune up and down on demand when it's really needed, instead of buying the biggest machine on the planet in case that there's a pain point in performance. Again, our philosophy is zero footprint at our clients. So we don't allow consultants to do any customizations on site. If banks need a specific PD or LGD model, we're going to build it for them and integrate it in our platform. And this is incredible when you think about, you know, being able to go in a matter of hours or days into the next release, the next version. Because regulation is changing all the time. Yeah, so if you're stuck with the version because, you know, you had so much customization going on site and it makes it almost impossible to migrate, then you're stuck. That version becomes stale very, very fast. Yeah. So in that environment, what we're trying to do is to say, look, we make sure you stay compliant because we have a zero footprint at the client site. So you can upgrade in a matter of days.
And I guess even beyond, even if there was no footprint, right? The fact that it's SaaS-based means that upgrades are part of it, I'm presuming. Like that an upgrade in itself is going to be extremely taken care of. So that's, I mean, an upgrade can take a year.
Correct.
Exactly. So yeah. Something that can normally take a year for some technical upgrade is now done instantly for them without anything to worry about, right? That's the upgrade component. Then you have the SaaS component as well. But you also mentioned something interesting. Productizing some of these upgrades means you have economies of scale, I presume. So you build it once, you deploy it, you can spread the cost very cost effectively across the client's profit. Right, and that's kind of groundbreaking, I guess, for many different compared to other solutions. Is that an accurate summary?
No, that's correct. That's also one of the reasons why we don't go into the compliance reports themselves, because then you're stuck to a certain country, which you have to maintain, and in the end, all the efforts are going in, and you know, making sure the reports are still up to date. We said, okay, we want to focus on global regulatory risk trends. So that you solve the issue once, then you can, you know, it's available for everybody. And it's really productized.
So beyond SaaS, Chris, beyond SaaS as a solution and an upgrade to the banking industry or the finance industry in general, is there something else that you're predicting beyond that? Like, is there an AI component or a blockchain, or are there certain components, like knowing that where the tech is heading now, right? And some industries are adopting. Do you see some other aspects coming your way beyond SaaS?
That you're certainly in the space of the modeling, the advanced modeling space. So we see more and more institutions using AI technology, certainly when they do modeling for their retail portfolios. Yeah. So that's a component which will become very important in the future. Also, what we're trying to do is to put intelligence in the data analysis and the big data analysis to say, let's see if if there are outliers in there that need special attention. So you're trying to build intelligence within the whole space of data analytics, but also as an input side in what's going into the advanced models. And that becomes more and more important, and there's also a lot of ethical questions being raised around the use of AI in the whole modeling space for the portfolios. And it's very important that people understand what that logic still is, and that people can explain what ultimately drives a go or non-go when someone knocks on the door to ask for a loan.
And I guess explainability is one thing, but you mentioned something interesting, ethics. Could you give an example of where you would apply ethics to the modeling?
It's a touchy subject to say. Fine, and certainly in the space of credit risk, retail portfolios, in terms of background of people, educational settings, race, religion, all the parameters that go ultimately in the model. And someone needs to supervise it. That AI thing is not going too crazy.
Rogue.
Overgeneralized based on past data.
Overgeneralizing.
Like this religion is impacting. So let's make some. Okay, interesting.
Which is a very topic for the moment.
Though. Oh yeah. Chris, so
also the whole, one of the fascinating areas is the whole ESG, especially around climate risk, that the regulators are asking the banks to do their homework to say, look, fine, we want to see, banks are often used to do the homework for the political decision makers, in terms of gathering data, in terms of analyzing the data. In terms of the green certificates that related to houses or to companies have specific ratings, again that will increase a lot the compliance cost again, because certainly in Europe banks are being pushed to do stress tests in terms of what that transition will cost them. And examples would be to say, for example, in the credit risk space, is collateral, where is it located? Is it somewhere located in an area which is prone to flooding? What about a green certificate for a certain collateral increases massively the value of a certain collateral? So all these things now need to be gathered on the most granular level. So it's a massive exercise. There's also, imagine, when they ask you to calculate the potential risk over, 10, 15 years, the kind of simulations which are needed. Worst case scenario, orderly transition, these kind of scenarios, it's quite some interesting cases there.
It sounds like it's going to be good for the world in general, anyway, if the value of a collateral goes up by a green certificate, as long as it's not too greenwashy, and the banks do their job really well, and you build the right tech, Chris, it sounds like ultimately it will enforce the right behavior.
No, true, and that's also, you know, what the political decision makers are forcing to that. You know, when you're going to have a corporate in a certain sector which is not that green, you know, their operation costs become much higher, and you decision maker will try banks also to help in that transition to a greener economy. Like, it more expensive for either people or for corporates who are not following that transition. So it's ultimately a very good case.
Well, and these are things that are definitely and obviously not easy to do, Chris. But what in your companies, what in starting it and in running it excites you? That you can imagine after a successful startup, you can just say, okay, I'm gonna retire now, I'm gonna go on an early pension, not worry about anything. But then you start another company. And so what drives you?
Well, I tried retirement for 6 months in Bangkok, but I said, okay, I have to go back to work, otherwise I'm not going to survive. you know, the joy of you know, being able to work in a team on with new technology, you know, addressing some of the key areas of making cost for compliance much lower than before. I mean, it's fascinating, you know. I do love to work in this industry. I love to work with you know, very good people that we have in the team. So it's yeah. I have no plans to retire again.
Maybe even start a third company in the future.
No. For me, that's it. I mean, I'm also, we don't have the pressure of external capital because we're self-funded. Mm-hmm. Part two, of course, is the success of the first company. So that gives a certain freedom to say, now we just have to focus on the product, you know, the references, you know, doing the right things. This is it, exactly. This is it.
And if you could do something different in your first company with everything that you've learned from it and starting your next company now, what would you have done anything differently?
It's a good question. I honestly don't think so. I honestly don't think so. We had a great journey for 15 years. You know, a very successful exit. A lot of, you know, entrepreneurial spin-offs from that part. I moved to this area, which I love, this part of the world. And yeah, I'm very happy to say, okay, we could start again, you know, in this adventure with a lot of people from the first gang. And you know, some people tell me, okay, Chris, you've done it before, so you know what to do. It must be much easier, but forget it. It's not true, you know. You know how painful it is, and you know the kind of key steps that you need to have the first 5 years. First 5 years are the most difficult ones for every startup. It's about getting the right people on board. Of course, when you do it the second time, you have a lot of people that you know and you bring with you, so that's easier. But the rest is, you know, you have to have a product which is not marginally better, but is far superior than the existing players. Because otherwise, forget it, no financial institution will buy something marginally better. They're not going to risk that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, building up references in this space is difficult. You know, you go to a bank, you're in the selection, they ask you, okay, can you give me the 3 years financial statements? Hello, we're a startup. Yeah. So you really, I mean, we were very lucky that very early, you know, what, the biggest bank in Indonesia, you know, realized that platform could do what they wanted to do. They only had a window of you know, 3-4 hours to run their calculations. And, you know, they tested the platform and said, yeah, this has the, you know, the capacity to do it. So we were very lucky that you know, because often you're confronted with, you know, pages and pages of RFIs, RFPs. They ask for features. Features. Instead of looking, you know, what's you know, what's the, underneath the platform, you know, what does it do different, you know? And you know, we always try to convince people that we talk to say, look, don't believe a word what we're saying. I know it sounds much too good, because also the industry has a very bad reputation, you know, over promising and under delivering. So I said, look, don't believe a word what I'm saying. Just, you know, test the product out free of charge and see what it does, see what it can do, the capacity of what's possible. And you know, once people have tested it, they say, okay, it is true. It is, you know, drastically different than existing players. So another part in the startup scene is make sure you keep your eye constant on the runway. You know, the number of months you can survive with your existing cash, because I see a lot of startups who are too optimistic, you know, and certainly when you're building a product, it takes a long time before the first revenues are coming in. So you have to make sure that you survive that period. So team, product, references, cash. That's what it's all about.
And is there something you took from startup one, business one, besides people, okay, that you then brought to two, where you say, I learned so much and this is going to fast track and really turbo boost the way I'm going to execute on business two? Like, I mean, 15 years of entrepreneurial experience must have brought quite a bit of something for your second business.
The first thing we sat together and say, okay, what are the lessons learned? You know, what should we be able to do better? Yeah. That was the first thing we did. So instead of like rules engine, yes, no. Yeah. Implementation times, all the things that we've done in the first, like a rules engine is a great example. You know, when we were at FinOut, we had a great rules engine. So typically an implementation was sending an army of consultants who kind of used rules engine to do exactly what the client wanted. Yeah, which as such, nothing bad about it, but it comes with certain consequences. And one of them is that you leave a very big footprint at the client. So there's a lot of customization that has done, and not a lot of all these goodies are flowing back into the products. So that was one of a very key important lesson, and that's basically nothing to do with technology, but more kind of an approach to say, look, we're not going to head that path. And that has painful financial consequences, because you lose that beautiful consulting revenue, you know, certainly in the first couple of years, because you have to build everything within the product free of charge. But ultimately, I mean, the advantages is huge, no? And you're continuously as such also enriching the product. You know, when we're now in the space of IFRS 9, it's frankly impossible to lose an IFRS 9 opportunity, because, you know, we've done maybe 30 implementations on IFRS 9. It's all within the product. So we have all these, you know, the models that they can choose from. It's crazy. So it's you sit down, okay, rules engine, speed of implementation, you know, performance, data duplication, all these kind of stuff that you say, we're going to try to do it drastically different. Because if you don't do that, you're going to make the same mistakes all over again.
It sounds like a very deep understanding of the domain and the systems and the approaches that you build up as you go and assess, you build your business and compare yourself, and now you have a blank slate and you can start again. Well, that seems to be like
I'm not Elon Musk, who is good in so many things. I'm only good in one thing. So yeah, this is the risk domain.
Fascinating.
Well, you can try to get out of your comfort zone again, Chris. And
you went from Belgium to London after all, Chris. That's that's a jump.
But it's also
because you know you're in Bangkok.
It's also a lesson learned is to stay focused, huh? because you get a lot of questions from your clients to say, why don't you do this for us? And then you have to have discipline to say, no, because we want to be the best company in these specific, you know, risk management solutions. You have to sometimes often say no, because it's important as a player to say, okay, this is our domain, this is what we're super good at.
Do you find that refreshing to be able to say no?
It's painful, but you have to.
I did it a couple of times. Let's say more than once in the last 12 months, and I find it very, very refreshing to be able to do it. It's painful, but in the bigger scheme of things, it shows that you're focused.
Yeah, indeed.
I like it.
Indeed. I think our clients like that as well. From us to say, okay, you know, these guys every year they bring up a new version. It's always improving what they're doing. You know, it's enriching. It's we're not doing 1,001 different things. We stick to what we're good at.
And you work mostly with big banks, Chris, or you also work with smaller banks?
It's a very good question. You know, with our first company, because of the way solution was built, the way the solution was implemented, you could only target mid-size and big banks. You know, when we have this, everything is coming out of the box approach, we have very small clients as well. We can implement, we did an implementation in Australia for one of the smaller mutual funds in 4 weeks, a BaaS implementation, credit RWA. Mm-hmm. It runs in SaaS, so it's our pricing is on the volumes that our clients have. So if you come with 5,000 contracts, you pay this price. You come with 10 million contracts, it's a different ballgame. And it's very refreshing also to work with not only with the big boys, but also with digital banks, startup banks, smaller banks. It's nice. It's refreshing.
So beyond, you know, doing this with a team, conquering the world, you know, having fun, you know, operating in the space you're really good at. What's the vision, Chris? What's the end game?
The end game is the number one player globally in risk management platforms. We want to conquer the world.
Boom. And for businesses interested in connecting with you, Chris, where can they find you or how can they best get in touch with you?
Very easy to look for my name in LinkedIn. I have a very unique surname, Pupe. P-U-I-P-E, so very easy to find me back, or just on the website www.lesionnxt.com.
Fantastic. All right. Well, Chris, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Your
Thanks
insights.
Yeah, it was a
thank
pleasure.
Thank you. Your insights have definitely been incredible and valuable, and we think that all the work that you do in the fintech space is just absolutely incredible.
Thank you.
And well, it's a wrap for today's episode of Mangtas Nation. We hope you enjoy the conversation and learn something new today. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review. It helps others discover our show. We promise to be back next time with another great episode. And once again, this is Jackie DeMank.
And Wouter Delbare.
Stay tuned for the next episode of Mangtas Nation. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you for tuning in to Mangtas Nation. Mangtas, your curated marketplace for B2B outsourcing solutions. Follow our social media pages to know more about us. Sign up as a client or sign up as a vendor and be part of this global B2B marketplace. Join us at www.mangtas.com.